The Next CMO podcast explores topics that are on the minds of forward-thinking marketing leaders, from vision and strategy to leadership and emerging technologies. The Next CMO is sponsored by Planful, a platform to build, manage, and measure your marketing plan, track all your marketing spend, and connect your budget with outcomes to measure your ROI. Check it out at planful.com/marketing. Your CFO will love you for it. I'm your host, Scott Todaro, a 32-year marketing veteran, 7-time head of marketing, and co-author of the book, The Next CMO. Hello and welcome to another exciting episode of The Next CMO podcast. Today, I am joined by Tom Klein, who is going to give us a great rundown on a bunch of best practices that I think are going to really revolutionize the way you are doing marketing today. No pressure, Tom. But Tom, I'm so excited to have him on the call today because Tom's got a great background. Not only is he the CMO right now at Matterport, but he was also the CMO at MailChimp. And I know a lot of you probably either use the tool out there or you have somebody on your team that has, you know, having 6 years of having to do a MarTech product and being the CMO, there's a lot of pressure. And we all know that the CMOs usually last 1 year, 9 months. So congratulations, Tom. You absolutely quadrupled that. That is fantastic. Now, the other great thing about Tom is that he hasn't just done a couple of leadership roles. He's been doing this for 20 years. So we're going to get a lot of detail. We're going to get a lot of best practices, maybe a little pain as part of the discussion today. And the other great thing about Tom is he's classically trained in marketing. He's got an MBA from Wharton with a concentration in marketing, which will give hopefully some additional perspective is how we came up. Now, one of the things with Tom is that Tom and I are around the same age. So we actually remember marketing before there was the internet. And so we people that know marketing before the internet always have a unique perspective on the evolution. In fact, one of the questions I want to ask Tom today is the changes that he's seen over time and how it has affected him and what he's done to make those adjustments in with the teams that he's been working with. Now, the first question I wanted to throw out here to Tom, because we had our initial discussion, Tom was talking about product marketing. I thought he had a lot of good insights in product marketing. And I get a little worried these days because there are a lot of CMOs that don't own product marketing. They only own like branding and lead generation and PR. You don't own it. Listen to Tom and then go get it, right? Go ask for it and pull it back into your organization. So, Tom, in your perspective and all these years that you've been working in the industry and marketing, define product marketing and what does it mean to you? And what do you think traditional marketing teams can deploy with a good, solid product marketing function?
Well, I'll get right on that, Scott. Just to thank you for having me on, and it's an honor to talk to you. And I hope I live up to that initial billing there. As it relates to product marketing, I've built a couple of different product marketing teams at both the Matterport and at MailChimp, and so when I arrived there, there wasn't a product marketing. There wasn't really product management. So, big picture, I tend to think of product marketing as essentially marketing's role in innovation, in a company. And so if you start with there's a problem or an opportunity for the business to address, or like it's usually a customer problem. Let's start with a customer problem. How do you actually get from, a problem to essentially the launch of a product? Right. So everything from my customer has a problem to there's a product that shows up at the end and that the customer is using it. And my business is it's usually a SaaS product. So I want them to subscribe to it and keep paying me month after month. And now the way I like to think about it is that there's a sort of two big sort of steps, which are largely, okay, how do I define the product or service that's going to be offered, right? Working in tandem with the product team. And so that could be engineers and product designers. And, so in that place, marketing is sort of representing kind of the classic insight gathering role of like advocate for the customer, understanding, gathering insights, ethnographic observation, whatever it is, right? So all of this sort of marketing research kind of classically. And then once you have sort of the concept in place and the product is built or, you know, assembled or whatever the heck it is, your job as product marketing is essentially define how you're going to kind of take it to market. And so strictly speaking, those are your P's, you know, like, oh, how are we going to distribute it? What am I going to price it? How am I going to promote it? Like all those kind of classic business school things. But that is the classic. I mean, but it's the same if you're putting together a hot dog stand. So, or my usual example is donut shop. I guess for some reason I have an affinity for donut shop. So like, what are you going to price your donuts? And how, you know, are you going to be open on Sunday? All those different decisions about how you're going to take your product or service to market and then ultimately launch it, right? So that product marketing process is like really kind of a handshake with product, where initially marketing is kind of the, you know, probably more, sort of the second lead, if you will, focused on input from customers, and then takes over like, hey, we have it. Let's talk about how we actually get it out there in the market and how we make it successful. So big picture, that's how I think about product marketing. And wow, it's a very specific skill set and really great to have on your team. So I can't imagine being the CMO and not having a slate of product marketers to help run the show.
Yeah, me neither. I don't know why any marketer would take a job that didn't involve product marketing. And I think a couple of things you brought up that are really important here. The first thing is that it is kind of the innovation arm of the marketing team. When you're thinking about, and you brought this up, you brought up the messaging, you brought up the positioning, you brought up pricing, packaging. These are all things that should be owned in the product marketing team. And even if you do have a product marketing team and, you know, they're doing, you know, messaging work, they should own those other pieces. Remember, pricing and packaging are a marketing function, and the product marketing team should also be involved in how it gets distributed. Right? You should be working with the sales team to figure out what other channels you should be using to distribute the product. That's excellent. I hope everybody takes that to heart and they really start to come up with some sort of practice inside their marketing organization for product marketing if you don't already have it. Now, I promised that I would ask a question. It's the old guy question. Right. And so you've been around a long time. You've seen a lot of evolution. Marketing has been changing over time. What do you think have been the most significant pivot points that you've seen?
Yeah, I was one of those weirdos in the old world when I worked at Nabisco in the cookie and cracker business. That was in the early 90s. So before the internet existed, but the browser wasn't out. So not many people were on it. And so I was fascinated with the intersection of marketing and technology. And so that intersection went from being kind of a novelty or like a nothing to, you know, like in many ways, technology and software just sort of swallowed marketing in its entirety. And it's really based on the principle of that if you are in the old world, when a customer or consumer interacted with marketing, there wasn't really a trace. Nobody knew. And so you had people that would, you know, fill out, you know, I was thinking like the Nielsen surveys for TV, or, you know, you had all this sort of crazy things that were approximations. Whereas the wonderful thing about digital, it was the fact that, yes, there's a lot of digital exhaust for every consumer, everything you interact with, every click, every visit, every everything just generates a mountain of data. And marketing went from being a, you know, really like, you know, mostly art and a little bit of science to like a lot of science and a lot of data and a lot of mathematics. And so the art is still there, certainly, but, you know, there's a lot more information that's available to make decisions about where you invest, how do you optimize, and what does attribution look like? So just the level of sophistication is, you know, we went from, you know, I don't know, math 101 to like, there's I'm always looking for a PhD somewhere in the company to kind of help me with something. So you can throw as much math at it as you have. So I feel like that has been the big shift from sort of the Mad Men world to like the Math Men world, if that makes any sense. Yeah.
You're really dating us with the Mad Men reference.
Oh, yeah, exactly.
Back in the 60s.
Not as much day drinking or cigarettes.
I mean, you did. Noon. I mean, wow, you really take me. You know, it's funny because, like, a lot of us, when we went into marketing, at least I was in for undergrad, I thought I wanted to be going to advertising. And then I heard what that business is all about. And I, this is no offense to anybody that's in advertising. You know, I'm sure that it is not the same as it was back in the 60s. Probably a lot fewer people smoking in the office. But
right, exactly. Or at least, fewer martinis at lunch, that's for
yeah,
sure.
You need creativity, right? Sometimes you just need it, right? Anyways, but that's a great point that you're making. So, you know, look, you're in B2B technology right now. I mean, you worked at MailChimp. Talk to me about building a brand in B2B, because, you know, I think a lot of people struggle with it. They talk about building the brand. You see these gigantic projects. Look, I spent $250,000 creating a logo and some colors. But what does it really take in the B2B world? It's much different, obviously, in B2C. How do you approach it? What are the things that you look to do in the early stages that you think you could help a CMO at least build their branding project correctly and then try to grow that over time?
Yeah, and it is a very different environment. And I would say even between MailChimp and Matterport, I had a couple year stint at Chanel, and which is an incredible brand, which is like has a mystical sway over like a lot of people. And so it was fascinating to sort of see firsthand, you know, in a very consumer oriented environment, certainly super, super luxe. What is that? Right. So like a sort of where does that even come from? Because it's kind of crazy in an extreme. And a lot of it had to do with, as a mark of quality. And for the Chanel customer, there's an emotional benefit that's associated with the brand. Right. So and obviously a tremendous badge value. Right. Because what you're really doing is you're talking about yourself when you have a Chanel item and you're wearing it, and you're talking about it. And in many ways, I try to essentially transfer that same notion of for our customers. My customers can be real estate agents. They might be a project manager on a construction project, but you know, there's emotional benefits there, right? And so even if you work on, say, a construction project for the airport, you might have dreams of like, you know, incredibly cool construction projects that are maybe a little more glamorous than the airport. And you associate with, you know, maybe other architects or designers or, you know, kind of cool construction. And that's the emotional benefit that I would look to kind of communicate and kind of connect with people on. So even in a B2B environment, I think it's just as relevant to say, you know, obviously I'm gonna want to deliver a functional benefit very clearly. Like this will make your job easier. This will be, you know, this will add value to your project. This will cut the time of your effort. This will, you know, improve your ROI. I got to do all those sort of traditional kind of B2B kind of benefits, if you will. But then at an emotional level, like this is cool. This will help you get promoted. This is for you as a manager and as a leader, and also like a person. I think everybody's looking for meaning in their lives, right? And so ideally, even if in a B2B product, to have a little bit of humanity and kind of connect with people as people, you know, like adding that little special part on top of it is a way to kind of differentiate. I mean, it helps you differentiate your brand in its totality. So it's not just a better mousetrap. It's a mousetrap that actually makes you feel better.
And I look, that word feel is so incredible because let's be honest, Tom, we're going to sit here and talk and have this nice podcast. And probably 6 months from now, you won't remember a word that was said. But if I make you feel really good or I make you feel really bad, you'll remember me and the feeling that's associated with it. And absolutely. So if marketers do not understand this, and this is why this is such an important point that you're bringing up, if you can't make that emotional connection, you will not get that brand identification, right, where they're locking in with you. So excellent point. Now, one of the things that we talked about as we were, you know, preparing for this was unique value proposition. And that kind of dovetails in fairly nicely with a branding project because, you know, it's great to, you have a nice brand and it's creating all these emotions, but eventually you're going to have some value proposition to sell, but something, right? So talk to me how you approach it, because I know you had a project that you did just recently at Matterport. How did you work on that and build a successful value prop?
Yeah, so I actually I did write a book that includes the chapter on this. My old business colleague refers to it as the undiscovered classic. But essentially, developing a value proposition or a brand architecture, and like I have my sort of pet approach to it, which is largely, you know, in many ways, kind of, you know, we just finished an election cycle. It's sort of based in that same notion of like, if I put a bunch of statements about sort of benefit statements in front of a targeted customer and ask them about to essentially rank the importance of it, and then have a follow-on question around, now if you're, you know, if the brand was able to deliver all those benefits that you know, identified as important, how likely, and then essentially tie those to, you know, likelihood to purchase. And so it's a little bit of a statistical trick of being able to say, you know, there's some things that people say that are important, but then there's some things that really are important. And you're trying to kind of pull all these benefit statements apart, because I think that's a challenge as marketers, is we're like, well, I could say almost anything. Like, I have all these things I could talk about. And how do I make a distinction between the ones that are sort of like, you know, I have to say just to not get dinged because they're not there, but I want to figure out the ones that are really highly differentiating and the ones that are motivating to say like, okay, I'm ready to part with money, you know, for your product and your brand because you said that, or at least to give you consideration. And so that's sort of like the method. Hopefully that makes sense to people, but getting out in front of customers largely is the way to do it, because I would propose sitting with your colleagues is not the way to do it. That's probably, you know, I'd like to start probably with a, you know, sort of a qualitative session, because sometimes it's helpful to just say, you know, dream up benefits with existing customers in a qualitative setting, and then use that for quant if you're depends on the appetite and like what your budget is and all that other stuff. So, but in general, just putting enough, trying to figure out which things do they say might be important and which things really get them to, you know, increase the likelihood to purchase, and then craft a statement, basically a value proposition that's layered with, you know, emotional benefits and functional benefits. And then that's what you use to kind of as the core to figure out, what do I communicate across all of my touch points?
But this is really important, because honestly, I think what ends up happening a lot of times when people go about building the value proposition, building out their messaging, or they start with a positioning statement, you know, at the end of the day, they really kind of start in the middle of the process. One of the things that you and I discussed was around marketing and involved in product. Now, you brought up the four P's of marketing, and I think marketing on the B2B side has really lost its credibility with the product team. We have engineers and product managers that are making decisions. I would argue that the product manager should report into marketing too. That way you're getting that perspective. So when you look at, you know, the function and working with the development organization, because let's face it, marketing is understanding who the target market is, what their needs are, what their wants are, crafting the messages. When you're doing the competitive analysis, how do you work with the development team to make sure that they're doing the right things to make sure that your business is sustainable over time?
Yeah, that's so key, right? And you know, the way we're currently structured is really, you know, like a pod. You know, so like I've got product marketers that are kind of attached to product managers, and that, you know, that setup that I described, and certainly trying to keep the team members in their swim lanes is always, can be challenging, right? Because I think you know, I was just thinking about this, working on that this week, which is, you know, sort of decision authority, right? So how do I get, essentially, I want a lot of really smart, creative, sometimes hard charging, sometimes sharp elbowed people together trying to solve a customer problem, but also have clarity around, okay, who's input, who's actually performing the tasks, who has, you know, sort of veto power, who is the decider whether we're going to do it or not. And so getting that put together is critical. And so a lot of times it's not necessarily the org design with the boxes. It's more about, okay, have we landed on an approach to essentially socialize decision authority before we even get into a project? And that has been consistent pretty much everywhere. Like having, like, who has the D? There's a bunch of stuff out there that's sort of helpful. That's, I think there's a Bain article about that, that is helpful for clarifying that, because otherwise it can be, you know, it's very easy to face a lot of resistance. And you know, it's worth the homework up front to clarify who's making what decision. And that's one of the keys, I would say.
I completely agree with it. Well, you've gone through a lot of really strategic elements here. I'm going to ask you a tactical question, because I think a lot of people are like wondering about user-generated content. They're asking about AI and what does that mean to things like product marketing? Are we going to need product marketing to write as much stuff? If they have some of the core messages, can they actually use the AI to write off of those core messages and come up with compelling content? So, you know, those are two things. I'm sure you could riff on this for a while, so I'm just going to let you run with it. But these are things that I think from a tactic standpoint that we're seeing are bubbling up to the CMO level, where they're saying, what's your process around? What's your strategy? How should we be attacking this? And so from your perspective, you know, how have you addressed it? And, you know, what are you doing right now to try to make it reality?
Yeah, I feel this question a lot from my CEO, right? So just like, okay, so why do I have to pay for this or that? Are we not, you know, everyone is sort of fuzzy on what is doable. Why can't I have a $500,000 commercial with a prompt into a chatbot? I'm like, not quite there. We're all excited about it. So, you know, big picture, as it relates to user generated content for actually both of those categories, you know, given the nature of the business that we're in, and then I have a range, you know, I have a SaaS product, I have over a billion, you know, visitors every year to Matterport. I'm probably most, you know, if I go back to that first question about product marketing, that's really where I'm trying to think about, okay, what am I doing really for my customer? Because honestly, my marketing team isn't that large. So like, I'm looking for all the leverage, but if I can do great things for those billion visitors and all my customers, that's a lot more leverage, right? And sometimes it's, so for example, user-generated content, when people create a Matterport, we created a product. It's like user generated home for Matterports. If you go to matterport.com/discover, when you sort of like YouTube, every time you create a YouTube, there's like, you find it on YouTube. And so creating a place where sharing just happens automatically, and it's a value, and you can find things. And if you said, I want a Matterport of, you know, Versailles, okay, go to this place and type in Versailles, and that's how you find it. And of course, that's helpful to the brand and to Matterport, because when people do that, I have pretty good SEO with all those visitors and all that stuff, right? So the work that I'm doing behind the scenes is working with my SEO agency and the product team to make sure that that's all coordinated. Same goes for addresses and all sorts of things like that. So if you're able to make your product itself generate content, that's really kind of a big winner, because, you know, search still matters. And then as it relates to AI, we have a lot of AI things that are getting built into the product, again, because it's helpful to customers, right? And it sort of speeds them along their way, adds value, and there's a big functional benefit. And there's, as you would imagine, there's an expectation from customers like that's important. Now, as it relates to actual marketing tactical execution, I guess, we have a couple of initiatives around essentially looking at the marketing process in total, and really being a, you know, a culture of experimentation of what could I do, right? So where do I aim, kind of, whether it's ChatGPT on, for example, we are using it for translations. So a bunch of things that are, you know, for $20 a month, you know, my person, and I only have one person and one marketeer in Japan, he can do a lot, you know, as opposed to a $150,000 SaaS product. So there are things that we can do to sort of, you know, enable individuals just with the LLMs and the chat kind of capabilities. And then beyond that, we are looking at sort of every different kind of creative element. Sometimes it's just getting people started because it's hard to start with a blank page, or reviewing, editing, essentially anywhere sort of in the creative process, want to use it as just as an assistant to kind of get things moving. It's certainly, I certainly don't see it as I don't want things to run through AI without a human looking at it, because that's a kind of we're just not there, right? That's a bit of a recipe for disaster. I think beyond that, I was thinking of another AI thing that's going on. I'm particularly interested, from a media perspective and an investment perspective, I'm interested in their nirvana of saying, how do I close my loop? You know, so if I'm making all these different marketing investments in maybe Meta and on Google, and, you know, I'm buying ads in all these places, and I have the analytics is challenging, right? Because it shows up, it might show up as a click in an email, it might show up as a visit to my site or a form fill or all these different things. I'm trying to, you know, I'm most interested in feeding all of that into an LLM and having, you know, better, easier, faster answers about which marketing investments are working and which ones are not. And so that is the thing that I'm probably most excited about, and I've got the team most focused on, as opposed to, you know, I'm not, you know, whatever, as if it comes to making a video ad, it just doesn't, it's not quite not weird yet to kind of do a prompt and say, can you make a video ad? It's just, you know, whatever. We're not there yet, but if it would help with analytics, that would go a long way.
Yeah, it's interesting. In my class last night, because I teach a marketing class to MBA students, so I said, I want you to create a TikTok ad. And they've all went straight to AI and literally created the TikTok ad from AI. They were all terrible. So it works. It created an ad. It was the right length. But I mean, I wouldn't show that to anyone. You know, if we're going to do that in the real world, I mean, if you want to cut corners, it's there for you. I think the technology is coming. I think it works.
Yes.
But I think for real value, I think it's still probably 4 to 5 years away.
Yes, you know, my creative director has a thing, because he's like, okay, I can't remember what he refers to it, but basically create your own crappy version, because then at least he can see what you mean. And in some ways it's a good, if as opposed to just the, in addition to your sort of the classic brief, right, for creative, go ahead and feed all that into, you know, create your crummy TikTok ad, so at least I see sort of where you're going.
Yeah.
And it's helpful for him, right? When he says, okay, now I know I have an idea, right? Okay. So it can be helpful that way too.
Yeah, without a doubt. All right, well, this brings us to the final question, which is, if you had one piece of advice to give either CMOs or people aspiring to become CMOs, what is the best piece of advice you could give them?
I usually have two pieces.
That's fine.
For my
you got
team.
Two. You can go for it. Give two.
Yeah. So, and these are, they're just going to sound obvious, but the first is test and learn. And so just experimentation, a lot of time isn't, that muscle isn't there by default. And so testing and learning and creating that sort of environment is not only good for you as marketing or as a CMO, but also it's liberating creatively for the team. And so if you're able to say, hey, I'm gonna, you know, like the testing, you know, you want people to feel like they can be creative and be different, and a lot of times the weird version of a thing might win. And so it's a very liberating thing to feel like, well, the contest is really how to connect with customers. And so, but if you don't make enough of a try, you risk being boring or repetitive. So the test and learn is really more about liberating people, and not just marketing, like your creative team, letting them be as creative as possible, because that increases the likelihood you're actually going to connect with your customer. So that was number one. And the other one is really more for people that are doing the marketing, is really, you know, put your heart into it, right? Because if it's not there, it's kind of obvious, right? So like, you know, put yourself, and that is also a little bit of like, as a brand, and when you're communicating, there's another person on the other side of this who is receiving the communication. So being real, being funny, being different, those are all great things. And it's a way, and just because you're a B2B brand doesn't mean you have to be boring or forgettable, right? So those are my two biggies.
So I want to key on this. I'm going to actually talk about both of them, but this last one you brought up, and I want this to be a throw out, not only to the CMOs. I tend to find that they're usually pretty passionate about their work, but you have got to get the people on your team passionate about the work that they're doing. And if you get them passionate, then it's going to be less work for you. If people are just doing checkbox marketing, and there are too many teams out there that have half their staff is just tell me what to do and I'll get it done by the end of the day. They don't care as long as the check is done. I got it out the door. They're not really thinking about the buyer. They're not really thinking about the message. They're not really thinking about the impact. Can't tell you how many times people send me emails like, hey, will you proof this email and approve it? Like, where's the subject line? And like, you didn't start with the subject line. You wrote it.
Exactly.
And then open it, right? I mean, it's like one of those things, like be cognizant of who that audience is and what is it going to take for them to open it up. And to your point, be creative, right? That's the great thing about marketing. You made the point, and I agree 100%, that we're getting more scientific with marketing than we've ever been. You need to be measuring all your metrics. You need to be measuring your ROI right now. You can't just wing it anymore. But when you get those answers, that gives you the freedom to start to experiment with things that are more creative. It's like it literally feeds itself, right? And so be thinking that way. It's not one or the other. It's both. One feeds the other. And the other thing that I want to bring up, and you mentioned testing. Do you do a lot of A-B testing? You like A-B testing?
So, I mean, it's a really everywhere. So not only in the email, either multivariate or A-B or lots of testing on the site around what performs as sort of like an ongoing effort. And certainly the way the ad networks work now is like they sort of, ruthlessly prune ads that don't work, automatically. So that's pretty handy. So you're not paying media for things that aren't working. So, but yes, lots of it.
Yeah. The interesting thing, the way I've always used A-B testing was a tiebreaker when two of my team members were about to go to blows, right? Like, hey, why don't we'll run both of them for a small sample and we'll see what we get on it. But I know it's harder for marketers to come up with several different treatments of an ad or a message or an email, whatever it is. I understand it's more work to do that. But if you put that goes to the passion point that you were making before, taking pride in your work, wanting it to be successful, putting two versions out that you believe both could work, but you're not really sure, testing it. I can't agree with you more on that point, Tom. I mean, this has been a fantastic conversation. I really hope that everybody got to the end of this, because I think there's a lot of learnings here that you can take away and deploy, especially the product marketing piece. Be looking at other parts of the business, get into pricing, get into packaging, get into distribution channels, get into the product, like Tom was mentioning here. These are important elements to make you a better marketer. And by the way, it's going to give you more power. The more elements that you own and you pull together gives you more power. And people say, well, I don't own that, or I don't feel comfortable. Get comfortable, right?
It's the fun part, really.
Yeah. I mean, to push yourself to learn these new elements. And you find yourself actually doing a better job. Like people saying, why do I need to own pricing? Well, if you price it really high, doesn't that mess up your messaging? If you don't have a product that fits the price, right? If the packaging is too complex and you're trying to message against it, doesn't that mess up your messaging? Right? So it all works together. It's all got to fit that brand message that you mentioned. You got to build that brand, and then finally then add that special spice to it to get people to connect with it emotionally. And I think in that case, then you'll find yourself doing a good job. You'll be like Tom, you spend 6 years at Survey at MailChimp, right? And that'll give you the opportunity to make a lot of money. Hopefully you made a lot of money.
I benefit from like a great team, right? Because you know, it's one of the strange things about being a CMO is like basically everybody else does everything, and a lot of times you get to take the credit. So a little humility goes a long way.
You know, it's so true. It was funny. My friend Peter Mahoney, who used to do this podcast, he was speaking at the Exit 5 conference, and one of the comments that they said is like, you know, if you're a CMO, what should you want to get rid of, right? And Peter said, doing marketing, right? Because you know, a lot of times what ends up happening is like, if you have a big enough team, you actually are so removed from doing the actual marketing on a day-to-day basis. You find yourself just kind of managing the processes. But what I will say is, if you do find yourself getting disconnected, make sure you still are involved in the planning process for the year.
Yes.
Set the goals, set the strategies, and make sure everybody on their team understands the goals and what their role is for achieving them. They understand what the strategies mean so they can deploy them as part of their campaigns and other things. Otherwise, I can guarantee you, you will be swimming upstream, okay? But I'm sure Tom would agree. But
absolutely.
All right. Yeah. Well, Tom, thanks again. This has been fantastic.
Thanks,
I would love to have you on another podcast at some point. And for the rest of you, thank you for the time. And I look forward to seeing you on a future of the next CMO podcast.